source and vibe. I read them not merely because I loved black music, I did, but because of the writing itself. Writers, Greg Tate, Chairman Mao, Dream Hampton, barely older than me, were out there creating a new language, one that I intuitively understood, to analyze our art, our world. This was, in and of itself, an argument for the weight and beauty of our culture and thus of our bodies. And now each day out on the yard, I felt this weight and saw this beauty, not just as a matter of theory, but also as demonstrable fact. And I wanted desperately to communicate this evidence to the world because I felt, even if I did not completely know, that the larger culture's erasure of black beauty was intimately connected to the destruction of black bodies. What was required was a new story, a new history, told through the lens of our struggle. I had always known this, had heard the need for a new history in Malcolm, had seen the need addressed in my father's books. It was in the promise behind their grand titles, Children of the Sun, Wonderful Ethiopians of the Ancient Kushite Empire, The African Origins of Civilization. Here was not just our history, but the history of the world, weaponized to our noble ends. Here was the primordial stuff of our own dream, the dream of a black race, of our own Tolstoys who lived deep in the African past, where we authored operas, pioneered secret algebra, erected ornate walls, pyramids, colossi, bridges, roads, and all the inventions that I then thought must qualify one's lineage for the ranks of civilization. They had their champions, and somewhere we must have ours. By then I'd read Chancellor Williams, J.A. Rogers, and John Jackson, writers central to the canon of our new noble history. From them I knew that Mansa Musa of Mali was black, and Shabaka of Egypt was black, and Ya Asantewaa of Ashanti was black, and the black race was a thing I suppose existed from time immemorial, a thing that was real and mattered. When I came to Howard, Chancellor Williams' destruction of black civilization was my Bible. Williams himself had taught at Howard. I read him when I was 16, and his work offered a grand theory of multi-millennial European plunder. The theory relieved me of certain troubling questions. This is the point of nationalism, and it gave me my Tolstoy. I read about Queen Nzinga, who ruled in Central Africa in the 16th century resisting the Portuguese. I read about her negotiating with the Dutch. When the Dutch ambassador tried to humiliate her by refusing her a seat, Nzinga had shown her power by ordering one of her advisors to all fours to make a human chair of her body. That was the kind of power I sought, and the story of our own royalty became for me a weapon. My working theory then held all black people as kings in exile, a nation of original men, severed from our original names and our majestic Nubian culture. Surely this was the message I took from gazing out on the yard. Had any people anywhere ever been as sprawling and beautiful as us? I needed more books. At Howard University, one of the greatest collections of books could be found in the Moreland Spingarn Research Center, where your grandfather once worked. Moreland held archives, papers, collections, and virtually any book ever written by or about black people. For the most significant portion of my time at the Mecca, I followed a simple ritual. I would walk into the Moreland reading room and fill out 3 call slips for 3 different works. I would take a seat at one of these long tables. I would draw out my pen and one of my black and white composition books. I would open the books and read while filling my composition books with notes on my reading, new vocabulary words, and sentences of my own invention. I would arrive in the morning and request 3 call slips at a time, the works of every writer I had heard spoken of in classrooms or out on the yard, Larry Neal, Eric Williams, George Padmore, Sonia Sanchez, Stanley Crouch, Harold Cruz, Manning Marable, Addison Gale, Carolyn Rogers, Etheridge Knight, Sterling Brown. I remember believing that the key to all life lay in articulating the precise difference between the black aesthetic and negritude. How specifically did Europe undevelop Africa? I must know. And if the 18th dynasty pharaohs were alive today, would they live in Harlem? I had to inhale all the pages. I went into this investigation imagining history to be a unified narrative free of debate which once uncovered would simply verify everything I had always suspected. The smokescreen would lift, and the villains who manipulated the schools and the streets would be unmasked. But there was so much to know, So much geography to cover. Africa, the Caribbean, the Americas, the United States. And all of these areas had history, sprawling literary canons, fieldwork, ethnographies. Where should I begin? The trouble came almost immediately. I did not find a coherent tradition marching lockstep, but instead factions and factions within factions. Hurston battled Hughes. Du Bois warred with Garvey. Harold Cruz fought everyone. I felt myself at the bridge of a great ship that I could not control because C.L.R. James was a great wave and Basil Davidson was a swirling eddy tossing me about. Things I believed merely a week earlier, ideas I had taken from one book could be smashed to splinters by another. Had we retained any of our African inheritance? Frazier says it was all destroyed, and this destruction evidences the terribleness of our capturers. Herskovitz says it lives on, and this evidences the resilience of our African spirit. By my second year, it was natural for me to spend a typical day mediating between Frederick Douglass's integration into America and Martin Delaney's escape into nationalism. Perhaps they were somehow both right. I had come looking for a parade, for a military review of champions marching in ranks. Instead, I was left with a brawl of ancestors, a herd of dissenters, sometimes marching together, but just as often marching away from each other. I would take breaks from my reading, walk out to the vendors who lined the streets, eat lunch on the yard. I would imagine Malcolm, his body bound in a cell, studying the books, trading his human eyes for the power of flight. And I too felt bound by my ignorance, by the questions that I had not yet understood to be more than just means, by my lack of understanding, and by Howard itself. It was still a school, after all. I wanted to pursue things, to know things, but I could not match the means of knowing that came naturally to me with the expectations of professors. The pursuit of knowing was freedom to me, the right to declare your own curiosities and follow them through all manner of books. I was made for the library, not the classroom. The classroom was a jail of other people's interests. The library was open, unending, free. Slowly I was discovering myself. The best parts of Malcolm pointed the way. Malcolm, always changing, always evolving, towards some truth that was ultimately outside the boundaries of his life, of his body. I felt myself in motion, still directed toward the total possession of my body, but by some other route, which I could not before then have imagined. I was not searching alone. I met your Uncle Ben at the Mecca. He was like me, from one of those cities where everyday life was so different than the dream that it demanded an explanation. He came, like me, to the Mecca, in search of the nature and origin of the breach. I shared with him a healthy skepticism and a deep belief that we could somehow read our way out. Ladies loved him, and what a place to be loved, for it was said, and we certainly believed it to be true, that nowhere on earth could one find a more beautiful assembly of women than on Howard University's yard. And somehow, even this was part of the search. The physical beauty of the black body was all our beauty, historical and cultural incarnate. Your Uncle Ben became a fellow traveler for life, and I discovered that there was something particular about journeying out with black people who knew the length of the road because they had traveled it too. I would walk out into the city and find other searchers at lectures, book signings, and poetry readings. I was still writing bad poetry. I read this bad poetry at open mics and local cafes populated mostly by other poets who also felt the insecurity of their bodies. All of these poets were older and wiser than me, and many of them were well-read. And they brought this wisdom to bear on me and my work. What did I mean specifically by the loss of my body? And if every black body was precious, a one of one, if Malcolm was correct, and you must preserve your life, how could I see these precious lives as simply a collective mass, as the amorphous residue of plunder? How could I privilege the spectrum of dark energy over each particular ray of light? These were notes on how to write, and thus notes on how to think. The dream thrives on generalization, on limiting the number of possible questions, on privileging immediate answers. The dream is the enemy of all art, courageous thinking, and honest writing. And it became clear that this was not just for the dreams concocted by Americans to justify themselves, but also for the dreams that I had conjured to replace them. I had thought that I must mirror the outside world, create a carbon copy of white claims to civilization. it was beginning to occur to me to question the logic of the claim itself. I had forgotten my own self-interrogations pushed upon me by my mother, or rather, I had not yet apprehended their deeper, lifelong meaning. I was only beginning to learn to be wary of my own humanity, of my own hurt and anger. I didn't yet realize that the boot on your neck is just as likely to make you delusional as it is to ennoble. The art I was coming to love lived in this void, in the not yet knowable, in the pain, in the question. The older poets introduced me to artists who pulled their energy from the void: Bubba Marley, Otis Redding, Sam and Dave, C.K. Williams, Carolyn Forché. The older poets were Ethelbert Miller, Kenneth Carroll, Brian Gilmore. It is important that I tell you their names, that you know that I have never achieved anything alone. I remember sitting with Joel Diaz-Porter, who had not gone to Howard, but whom I found at the Mecca, reviewing every line of Robert Hayden's Middle Passage. And I was stunned by how much Hayden managed to say without seemingly saying anything at all. He could bring forth joy and agony without literally writing the words, which formed as pictures and not slogans. Hayden imagined the enslaved during the Middle Passage from the perspective of the enslaver, a mind trip for me in and of itself. Why should the enslaver be allowed to speak? But Hayden's poems did not speak. They conjured. You cannot stare that hatred down, or chain the fear that stalks the watches. I was not in any slave ship. Or perhaps I was, because so much of what I felt in Baltimore, the sharp hatred, the immortal wish, and the timeless will, I saw in Hayden's work. And that was what I heard in Malcolm, but never like this, quiet, pure, and unadorned. I was learning the craft of poetry, which really was an intensive version of what my mother had taught me all those years ago, the craft of writing as the art of thinking. Poetry aims for an economy of truth. Loose and useless words must be discarded, and I found that these loose and useless words were not separate from loose and useless thoughts. Poetry was not simply the transcription of notions. Beautiful writing rarely is. I wanted to learn to write, which was ultimately still, as my mother had taught me, a confrontation with my own innocence, my own rationalizations. Poetry was the processing of my thoughts until the slag of justification fell away and I was left with the cold, still truths of life. These truths I heard in the works of other poets around the city. They were made of small, hard things. Aunts and uncles, smoke breaks after sex, girls on stoops, drinking from mason jars. These truths carried the black body beyond slogans and gave it color and texture, and thus reflected the spectrum I saw out on the yard more than all my alliterative talk of guns or revolutions or peons to the lost dynasties of African antiquity. After these readings, I followed as the poets would stand out on U Street or repair to a cafe and argue about everything. Books, politics, boxing. And their arguments reinforced the discordant tradition I found in Moreland, and I began to see discord, argument, chaos, perhaps even fear, as a kind of power. I was learning to live in the disquiet I felt in Moreland Spingarn, in the mess of my mind. The gnawing discomfort, the chaos, the intellectual vertigo was not an alarm, it was a beacon. It began to strike me that the point of my education was a kind of discomfort, was the process that would not award me my own especial dream, but would break all the dreams, all the comforting myths of Africa, of America, and everywhere, and would leave me only with humanity and all its terribleness. And there was so much terrible out there, even among us. You must understand this. Back then I knew, for instance, that just outside of Washington, D.C., there was a great enclave of black people, who seemed as much as anyone to have seized control of their bodies. This enclave was Prince George's County, PG County to the locals, and it was, to my eyes, very rich. Its residents had the same homes with the same backyards with the same bathrooms I'd seen in those televised dispatches. They were black people who elected their own politicians, but these politicians, I'd learned, superintended a police force as vicious as any in America. I had heard stories about PG County from the same poets who opened my world. These poets assured me that the PG County police were not police at all, but privateers, gangsters, gunmen, plunderers operating under the color of law. They told me this because they wanted to protect my body. But there was another lesson here. To be black and beautiful was not a matter for gloating. Being black did not immunize us from history's logic or the lure of the dream. the writer, and that was what I was becoming, must be wary of every dream and every nation, even his own nation, perhaps his own nation more than any other, precisely because it was his own. I began to feel that something more than a national trophy case was needed if I was to be truly free, and for that, I have the History Department of Howard University to thank. My history professors thought nothing of telling me that my search for myth was doomed, that the stories I wanted to tell myself could not be matched to truths. Indeed, they felt it their duty to disabuse me of my weaponized history. They had seen so many Malcolmites before and were ready. Their method was rough and direct. Did black skin really convey nobility? Always, yes. What about the blacks who'd practiced slavery for millennia and sold slaves across the Sahara and then across the sea? Victims of a trick. Would those be the same black kings who birthed all of civilization? Were they then both deposed masters of the galaxy and gullible puppets all at once? And what did I mean by black? You know, black. Did I think this a timeless category stretching into the deep past? Yes. Could it be supposed that simply because color was important to me, it had always been so? I remember taking a survey class focusing on Central Africa. My professor, Linda Haywood, was slight and bespectacled, spoke with a high Trinidadian lilt that she employed like a hammer against young students like me who confused agitprop with hard study. There was nothing romantic about her Africa, or rather there was nothing romantic in the sense that I had conceived of it. And she took it back to the legacy of Queen Nzinga, my Tolstoy, the very same Nzinga whose life I wished to put in my trophy case. But when she told the story of Nzinga conducting negotiations upon the woman's back, she told it without any fantastic gloss, and it hit me hard as a sucker punch. Among the people in that room, all those centuries ago, my body, breakable at will, endangered in the streets, fearful in the schools, was not closest to the queens, but to her advisors, who'd been broken down into a chair so that a queen, heir to everything she'd ever seen, could sit. I took a survey of Europe post-1800. I saw black people rendered through white eyes unlike any I'd seen before. The black people looked regal and human. I remember the soft face of Alessandro de' Medici, the royal bearing of Bosch's black magi. These images, cast in the 16th and 17th century, were contrasted with those created after enslavement, the Sambo caricatures I had always known. What was the difference? In my survey course of America, I'd seen portraits of the Irish drawn in the same ravenous, lustful, and simian way. Perhaps there had been other bodies mocked, terrorized, and insecure. Perhaps the Irish, too, had once lost their bodies. Perhaps being named black had nothing to do with any of this. Perhaps being named black was just someone's name for being at the bottom. A human turned to object. Object turned to pariah. This heap of realizations was a weight. I found them physically painful and exhausting. True, I was coming to enjoy the dizziness, the vertigo that must come with any odyssey, but in those early moments, the unceasing contradictions sent me into a gloom. There was nothing holy or particular in my skin. I was black because of history and heritage. There was no nobility in falling, in being bound, in living oppressed, and there was no inherent meaning in black blood. Black blood wasn't black. Black skin wasn't even black. And now I looked back on my need for a trophy case, on the desire to live by the standards of Saul Bellow, and I felt that this need was not an escape, but fear again. Fear that they, the alleged authors and heirs of the universe, were right. And this fear ran so deep that we accepted their standards of civilization and humanity. But not all of us. It must have been around that time that I discovered an essay by Ralph Wiley in which he responded to Bellow's quip. "Tolstoy is the Tolstoy of the Zulus," wrote Wiley. "Unless you find a profit in fencing off universal properties of mankind into exclusive tribal ownership." And there it was. I had accepted Bellow's premise. In fact, Bellow was no closer to Tolstoy than I was to Nzinga. And if I were closer, it would be because I chose to be, not because of destiny written in DNA. My great error was not that I had accepted someone else's dream, but that I had accepted the fact of dreams, the need for escape, and the invention of racecraft. And still and all, I knew that we were something, that we were a tribe, on one hand invented and on the other no less real. The reality was out there on the yard, on the first warm day of spring, when it seemed that every sector, borough, affiliation, county, and corner of the broad diaspora had sent a delegate to the Great World Party. I remember those days like an outcast song, painted in lust and joy. A bald head in shades and a tank top stands across from Blackburn, the student center, with a long boa draping his muscular shoulders. A conscious woman in stonewash with her dreads pulled back is giving him the side eye and laughing. I am standing outside the library, debating the Republican takeover of Congress or the place of Wu-Tang Clan in the canon. A dude in a Tribe Vibe t-shirt walks up, gives a pound, and we talk about the black bacchanals of the season, Freaknik, Daytona, Virginia Beach, and we wonder if this is the year we make the trip. It isn't, because we have all we need out on the yard. We are dazed here, because we still remember the hot cities in which we were born, where the first days of spring were laced with fear, and now, here at the Mecca, we are without fear. We are the dark spectrum on parade. These were my first days of adulthood, of living alone, of cooking for myself, of going and coming as I pleased, of my own room, of the chance of returning there perhaps with one of these beautiful women who are now everywhere around me. In my second year at Howard, I fell hard for a lovely girl from California, who was then in the habit of floating over the campus in a long skirt and head wrap. I remember her large brown eyes, her broad mouth and cool voice. I would see her out on the yard on those spring days, yell her name, and then throw up my hands as though signaling a touchdown, but wider, like the W in What Up. That was how we did it then. Her father was from Bangalore, and where was that, and what were the laws out there? I did not yet understand the import of my own questions. What I remember is my ignorance. I remember watching her eat with her hands and feeling wholly uncivilized with my fork. I remember wondering why she wore so many scarves. I remember her going to India for spring break and returning with a bindi on her head and photos of her smiling Indian cousins. I told her, "Nigga, you black," because that's all I had back then. But her beauty and stillness broke the balance in me. In my small apartment, she kissed me and the ground opened up, swallowed me, buried me right there in that moment. How many awful poems did I write thinking of her? I know now what she was to me, the first glimpse of a space bridge, a wormhole, a galactic portal off this bound and blind planet. She had seen other worlds, and she held the lineage of other worlds spectacularly in the vessel of her black body. I fell again, a short time later and in similar fashion, for another girl, tall with long flowing dreadlocks. She was raised by a Jewish mother in a small, nearly all-white town in Pennsylvania. And now at Howard, ranged between women and men, asserted this not just with pride, but as though it were normal, as though she were normal. I know it's nothing to you now, but I was from a place, America, where cruelty toward humans who loved as their deepest instincts instructed was a kind of law. I was amazed. This was something black people did. Yes, and they did so much more. The girl with the long dreads lived in a house with a man, a Howard professor, who was married to a white woman. The Howard professor slept with men. His wife slept with women. And the two of them slept with each other. They had a little boy who must be off to college by now. Faggot was a word I had employed all my life. And now, here they were. The cabal, the coven, the others, the monsters, the outsiders, the faggots, the dykes, dressed in all their human clothes. I am black and have been plundered and have lost my body. But perhaps I too had the capacity for plunder. Maybe I would take another human's body to confirm myself in a community. Perhaps I already had. Hate gives identity. The nigger, the fag, the bitch, illuminate the border, illuminate what we ostensibly are not, illuminate the dream of being white, of being a man. We name the hated strangers and are thus confirmed in the tribe. But my tribe was shattering and reforming around me. I saw these people often because they were family to someone whom I loved. Their ordinary moments, answering the door, cooking in the kitchen, dancing to Adina Howard, assaulted me and expanded my notion of the human spectrum. I would sit in the living room of that house observing their private jokes, one part of me judging them. the other reeling from the changes. She taught me to love in new ways. In my old house, your grandparents ruled with the fearsome rod. I have tried to address you differently, an idea begun by seeing all the other ways of love on display at the Mecca. Here is how it started. I woke up one morning with a minor headache. With each hour, the headache grew. I was walking to my job when I saw this girl on her way to class. I looked awful, and she gave me some Advil and kept going. By mid-afternoon, I could barely stand. I called my supervisor. When he arrived, I lay down in the stockroom, because I had no idea what else to do. I was afraid. I did not understand what was happening. I did not know whom to call. I was lying there simmering, half awake, hoping to recover. My supervisor knocked on the door. Someone had come to see me. It was her. The girl with the long dreads helped me out and onto the street. She flagged down a cab. Halfway through the ride, I opened the door with the cab in motion and vomited in the street. But I remember her holding me there to make sure I didn't fall out and then holding me close when I was done. She took me to that house of humans, which was filled with all manner of love, put me in the bed, put Exodus on the CD player, and turned the volume down to a whisper. She left a bucket by the bed. She left a jug of water. She had to go to class. I slept. When she returned, I was back in form. We ate. The girl with the long dreads who slept with whomever she chose, that being her own declaration of control over her body, was there. I grew up in a house drawn between love and fear. There was no room for softness, but this girl with the long dreads revealed something else, that love could be soft and understanding, that soft or hard love was an act of heroism. And I could no longer predict where I would find my heroes. Sometimes I would walk with friends down to U Street and hang out at the local clubs. This was the era of Bad Boy and Biggie, One More Chance and Hypnotize. I almost never danced, as much as I wanted to. I was crippled by some childhood fear of my own body. But I would watch how black people moved, how in these clubs they danced as though their bodies could do anything, and their bodies seemed as free as Malcolm's voice. On the outside, black people controlled nothing, least of all the fate of their bodies, which could be commandeered by the police, which could be erased by the guns which were so profligate, which could be raped, beaten, and jailed. But in the clubs, under the influence of two-for-one rum and cokes, under the spell of low lights, enthrall of hip-hop music, I felt them to be in total control of every step, every nod, every pivot. All I then wanted was to write as those black people danced, with control, power, joy, warmth. I was in and out of classes at Howard. I felt that it was time to go, to declare myself a graduate of the Mecca, if not the university. I was publishing music reviews, articles, and essays in the local alternative newspaper, and this meant contact with more human beings. I had editors, more teachers, and these were the first white people I'd ever really known on any personal level. They defied my presumptions. They were afraid neither for me nor of me. Instead, they saw in my unruly curiosity and softness something that was to be treasured and harnessed. And they gave me the art of journalism, a powerful technology for seekers. I reported on local DC, and I found that people would tell me things that the same softness that once made me a target now compelled people to trust me with their stories. This was incredible. I was barely out of the fog of childhood, where questions simply died in my head. Now I could call and ask people why a popular store closed, why a show had been canceled, why there were so many churches and so few supermarkets. Journalism gave me another tool for exploration, another way of unveiling the laws that bound my body. It was beginning to come together, even if I could not yet see what the it was. In Moreland, I could explore the histories and traditions. Out on the yard, I could see the traditions in effect. And with journalism, I could directly ask people about the two or about anything else I might wonder. So much of my life was defined by not knowing. Why did I live in a world where teenage boys stood in the parking lot of the 7-Eleven pulling out? Why was it normal for my father, like all the parents I knew, to reach for his belt? And why was life so different out there, in that other world, past the asteroids? What did the people whose images were once beamed into my living room have that I did not? The girl with the long dreads who changed me, whom I so wanted to love. She loved the boy about whom I think every day, and about whom I expect to think every day for the rest of my life. I think sometimes that he was an invention, and in some ways he is, because when the young are killed, they are haloed by all that was possible, all that was plundered. But I know that I had love for this boy, Prince Jones, which is to say that I would smile whenever I saw him, for I felt the warmth when I was around him, and was slightly sad when the time came to trade Dap and for one of us to go. The thing to understand about Prince Jones is that he exhibited the whole of his given name. He was handsome, he was tall and brown, built thin and powerful like a wide receiver. He was the son of a prominent doctor. He was born again, a state I did not share but respected. He was kind, generosity radiated off of him, and he seemed to have a facility with everyone and everything. This can never be true, but there are people who pull the illusion off without effort, and Prince was one of them. I can only say what I saw, what I felt. There are people whom we do not fully know, and yet they live in a warm place within us, and when they are plundered, when they lose their bodies, and the dark energy disperses, that place becomes a womb. I fell in love at the Mecca one last time, lost my balance and all my boyhood confusion under the spell of a girl from Chicago. This was your mother. I see her standing there with a group of friends in the living room of her home. I stood with a blunt in one hand and a beer in another. I inhaled, passed it off to the Chicago girl, and when I brushed her long, elegant fingers, I shuddered a bit from the blast. She brought the blunt to her plum-painted lips, pulled, exhaled, then pulled the smoke back in. A week earlier, I had kissed her, and now, watching this display of smoke and flame, and already feeling the effects, I was lost in running and wondering what it must be to embrace her, to be exhaled by her, to return to her and leave her high. She had never known her father, which put her in the company of the greater number of everyone I had known. I felt then that these men, these fathers, were the greatest of cowards. But I also felt that the galaxy was playing with loaded dice, which ensured an excess of cowards in our ranks. The girl from Chicago understood this too, and she understood something more. That all are not equally robbed of their bodies, that the bodies of women are set out for pillage in ways I could never truly know. And she was the kind of black girl who'd been told as a child that she had better be smart because her looks wouldn't save her, and then told as a young woman that she was really pretty for a dark-skinned girl. And so there was all about her a knowledge of cosmic injustices, the same knowledge I'd glimpsed all those years ago watching my father reach for his belt, watching the suburban dispatches in my living room, watching the golden-haired boys with their toy trucks and football cards, and dimly perceiving the great barrier between the world and me. Nothing between us was ever planned, not even you. We were both 24 years old when you were born, the normal age for most Americans. But among the class we soon found ourselves, we ranked as teenage parents. With a whiff of fear, we were very often asked if we planned to marry. Marriage was presented to us as a shield against other women, other men, or the corrosive monotony of dirty socks and dishwashing. But your mother and I knew too many people who'd married and abandoned each other for less. The truth of us was always that you were our ring. We'd summoned you out of ourselves, and you were not given a vote. If only for that reason you deserved all the protection we could muster. Everything else was subordinate to this fact. If that sounds like a weight, it shouldn't. The truth is that I owe you everything I have. Before you, I had my questions, but nothing beyond my own skin in the game. And that was really nothing at all, because I was a young man and not yet clear of my own human vulnerabilities. But I was grounded and domesticated by the plain fact that should I now go down, I would not go down alone. This is what I told myself, at least. It was comforting to believe that the fate of my body and the bodies of my family were under my powers. You will have to man up, we tell our sons. Anyone can make a baby, but it takes a man to be a father. This is what they had told me all my life. It was the language of survival, a myth that helped us cope with the human sacrifice that finds us no matter our manhood. As though our hands were ever our own, as though plunder of dark energy was not at the heart of our galaxy, and the plunder was there if I wished to see it. One summer I traveled out to Chicago to see your mother. I rode down the Dan Ryan with friends and beheld for the first time the State Street corridor, a four-mile stretch of dilapidated public housing. There were projects all over Baltimore, but nothing so expansive as this. The housing occurred to me as a moral disaster, not just for the people living there, but for the entire region, the metropolis of commuters who drove by each day, and with their silent acquiescence, tolerated such a thing. But there was so much more there in those projects than I was, even in all my curiosity, prepared to see. Your maternal grandmother once visited us during the pregnancy. She must have been horrified. We were living in Delaware. We had almost no furniture. I had left Howard without a degree and was living on the impoverished wages of a freelance writer. On the last day of her visit, I drove your grandmother to the airport. Your mother was her only child, as you are my only child. And having watched you grow, I know that nothing could possibly be more precious to her. She said to me, "You take care of my daughter." When she got out of the car, my world had shifted. I felt that I had crossed some threshold out of the foyer of my life and into the living room. Everything that was the past seemed to be another life. There was before you, and then there was after. And in this after, you were the God I'd never had. I submitted before your needs, and I knew then that I must survive for something more than survival's sake. I must survive for you. You were born that August. I thought of the great spectrum of the Mecca, black people from Belize, black people with Jewish mothers, black people with fathers from Bangalore, black people from Toronto and Kingston, black people who spoke Russian, who spoke Spanish, who played Mongo Santa Maria, who understood mathematics and sat up in bone labs, unearthing the mysteries of the enslaved. There was more out there than I had ever hoped for, and I wanted you to have it. I wanted you to know that the world in its entirety could never be found in the schools alone, nor on the streets alone, nor in the trophy case. I wanted you to claim the whole world as it is. I wanted Tolstoy is the Tolstoy of the Zulus to immediately be obvious to you. And yet even in this cosmopolitan wish, I felt the old power of ancestry, because I had come to knowledge at the Mecca that my ancestors made, and I was compelled toward the Mecca by the struggle that my ancestors made. The struggle is in your name, Samari. You were named for Samari Touré, who struggled against French colonizers for the right to his own black body. He died in captivity, but the profits of that struggle and others like it are ours, even when the object of our struggle, as is so often true, escapes our grasp. I learned this living among a people whom I would never have chosen, because the privileges of being black are not always self-evident. We are, as Derrick Bell once wrote, the faces at the bottom of the well. But there really is wisdom down here, and that wisdom accounts for much of the good in my life, and my life down here accounts for you. There was also wisdom in those streets. I think now of the old rule that held that should a boy be set upon in someone else's chancy hood, his friends must stand with him, and they must all take their beating together. I now know that within this edict lay the key to all living. None of us were promised to end the fight on our feet, fists raised to the sky. We could not control our enemy's numbers, strength, nor weaponry. Sometimes you just caught a bad one, but whether you fought or ran, you did it together, because that is the part that was in our control. What we must never do is willingly hand over our own bodies or the bodies of our friends. That was the wisdom. We knew we did not lay down the direction of the street, but despite that, we could and must fashion the way of our walk, and this is the deeper meaning of your name, that the struggle in and of itself has meaning. That wisdom is not unique to our people, but I think it has special meaning to those of us born out of mass rape, whose ancestors were carried off and divided up into policies and stocks. I have raised you to respect every human being as singular, and you must extend that same respect into the past. Slavery is not an indefinable mass of flesh. It is a particular, specific, enslaved woman, whose mind is as active as your own, whose range of feelings is as vast as your own, who prefers the way the light falls in one particular spot in the woods, who enjoys fishing where the water eddies in a nearby stream, who loves her mother in her own complicated way, thinks her sister talks too loud, has a favorite cousin, a favorite season, who excels at dressmaking, and knows inside herself that she is as intelligent and capable as anyone. Slavery is the same woman born in a world that loudly proclaims its love of freedom and inscribes this love in its essential text. A world in which these same professors hold this woman a slave, hold her mother a slave, her father a slave, her daughter a slave. And when this woman peers back into the generations, all she sees is the enslaved. She can hope for more. She can imagine some future for her grandchildren. But when she dies, the world, which is really the only world she can ever know, ends. For this woman, enslavement is not a parable. It is damnation. It is the never-ending night. And the length of that night is most of our history. Never forget that we were enslaved in this country longer than we have been free. Never forget that for 250 years, black people were born into chains, whole generations followed by more generations who knew nothing but chains. You must struggle to truly remember this past in all its nuance, error, and humanity. You must resist the common urge toward the comforting narrative of divine law, toward fairy tales that imply some irrepressible justice. The enslaved were not bricks in your road, and their lives were not chapters in your redemptive history. They were people turned to fuel for the American machine. Enslavement was not destined to end, and it is wrong to claim our present circumstance, no matter how improved, as the redemption for the lives of people who never asked for the posthumous, untouchable glory of dying for their children. Our triumphs can never compensate for this. Perhaps our triumphs are not even the point. Perhaps struggle is all we have because the God of history is an atheist and nothing about his world is meant to be. So you must wake up every morning knowing that no promise is unbreakable, least of all the promise of waking up at all. This is not despair. These are the preferences of the universe itself. Verbs over nouns, actions over states, struggle over hope. The birth of a better world is not ultimately up to you, though I know each day there are grown men and women who tell you otherwise. The world needs saving precisely because of the actions of these same men and women. I am not a cynic. I love you, and I love the world, and I love it more with every new inch I discover. But you are a black boy, and you must be responsible for your body in a way that other boys cannot know. Indeed, you must be responsible for the worst actions of other black bodies, which somehow will always be assigned to you. And you must be responsible for the bodies of the powerful. The policeman who cracks you with a nightstick will quickly find his excuse in your furtive movements. And this is not reducible to just you. The women around you must be responsible for their bodies in a way that you will never know. You have to make your peace with the chaos, but you cannot lie. You cannot forget how much they took from us and how they transfigured our very bodies into sugar, tobacco, cotton, and gold. 2. Our world is full of sound. Our world is more lovely than anyone's, though we suffer and kill each other and sometimes fail to walk the air. We are beautiful people with African imaginations, full of masks and dances and swelling chants, with African eyes and noses and arms, though we sprawl in gray chains in a place full of winters, when what we want is sun. Ameri Baraka. Shortly before you were born, I was pulled over by the PG County Police, the same police that all the DC poets had warned me of. They approached on both sides of the car, shining their flashing lights through the windows. They took my identification and returned to the squad car. I sat there in terror. By then I had added to the warnings of my teachers what I'd learned about PG County through reporting and reading the papers. And so I knew that the PG County police had killed Elmer Clay Newton, then claimed he'd rammed his own head into the wall of a jail cell. And I knew that they'd shot Gary Hopkins and said he'd gone for an officer's gun. And I knew they had beaten Freddie McCollum half-blind and blamed it all on a collapsing floor. And I had read reports of these officers choking mechanics, shooting construction workers, slamming suspects through the glass doors of shopping malls. And I knew that they did this with great regularity, as though moved by some unseen cosmic clock. I knew that they shot at moving cars, shot at the unarmed, shot through the backs of men and claimed it had been they who'd been under fire. These shooters were investigated, exonerated, and promptly returned to the streets, where, so emboldened, they shot again. At that point in American history, No police department fired its guns more than that of Prince George's County. The FBI opened multiple investigations, sometimes in the same week. The police chief was rewarded with a raise. I replayed all of this sitting there in my car, in their clutches. Better to have been shot in Baltimore, where there was the justice of the streets and someone might call the killer to account. But these officers had my body, could do with their body whatever they pleased, and should I live to explain what they had done with it, this complaint would mean nothing. The officer returned. He handed back my license. He gave no explanation for the stop. Then that September, I picked up the Washington Post and saw that the PG County Police had killed again. I could not help but think that this could have been me, and holding you, a month old by then, I knew that such loss would not be mine alone. I skimmed the headline. Their atrocity seemed so common back then. The story spread into a second day, and reading slightly closer, I saw it was a Howard student who had been killed. I thought perhaps I knew him, but I paid it no further mind. Then on the third day, a photo appeared with the story, and I glimpsed at and then focused on the portrait, and I saw him there. He was dressed in his formal clothes, as though it were his senior prom, and frozen in the amber of his youth. His face was lean, brown, and beautiful, and across that face I saw the open, easy smile of Prince Carmen Jones. I cannot remember what happened next. I think I stumbled back. I think I told your mother what I'd read. I think I called the girl with the long dreads and asked her if it could be true. I think she screamed. What I remember for sure is what I felt, rage and the old gravity of West Baltimore, the gravity that condemned me to the schools, the streets, the void. Prince Jones had made it through, and still they had taken him. And even though I already knew that I would never believe any account that justified this taking, I sat down to read the story. There were very few details. He had been shot by a PG County officer, not in PG County, not even in D.C., but somewhere in Northern Virginia. Prince had been driving to see his fiancée. He was killed yards from her home. The only witness to the killing of Prince Jones was the killer himself. The officer claimed that Prince had tried to run him over with his Jeep, and I knew that the prosecutors would believe him. Days later, your mother and I packed you into the car, drove down to Washington, left you with your Aunt Camilla, and went to the service for Prince at Rankin Chapel on Howard's campus, where I'd once sat amazed at the parade of activists and intellectuals, Joseph Lowry, Cornel West, Calvin Butts, who preached at that pulpit. I must have seen a great number of old friends there, though I cannot recall precisely who. What I remember is all the people who spoke of Prince's religious zeal, his abiding belief that Jesus was with him. I remember watching the president of the university stand and weep. I remember Dr. Mabel Jones, Prince's mother, speaking of her son's death as a call to move from her comfortable suburban life into activism. I heard several people ask for forgiveness for the officer who shot Prince Jones down. I only vaguely recall my impressions of all this. But I know that I have always felt great distance from the grieving rituals of my people, and I must have felt it powerfully then. The need to forgive the officer would not have moved me, because, even then, in some inchoate form, I knew that Prince was not killed by a single officer, so much as he was murdered by his country and all the fears that have marked it from birth. At this moment, the phrase police reform has come into vogue, and the actions of our publicly appointed guardians have attracted attention, presidential and pedestrian. You may have heard the talk of diversity, sensitivity training, and body cameras. These are all fine and applicable, but they understate the task and allow the citizens of this country to pretend that there is real distance between their own attitudes and those of the ones appointed to protect them. The truth is that the police reflect America in all of its will and fear, and whatever we might make of this country's criminal justice policy, it cannot be said that it was imposed by a repressive minority. The abuses that have followed from these policies, the sprawling carceral state, the random detention of black people, the torture of suspects, are the product of democratic will. And so to challenge the police is to challenge the American people, who send them into the ghettos armed with the same self-generated fears that compelled the people who think they are white to flee the cities and into the dream. The problem with the police is not that they are fascist pigs, but that our country is ruled by majoritarian pigs. I knew some of this even then, sitting in Rankin Chapel, even if I could not yet express it. So forgiving the killer of Prince Jones would have seemed irrelevant to me. The killer was the direct expression of all his country's beliefs, and raised conscious in rejection of a Christian God, I could see no higher purpose in Prince's death. I believed, and still do, that our bodies are ourselves, that my soul is the voltage conducted through neurons and nerves, and that my spirit is my flesh. Prince Jones was a one of one, and they had destroyed his body, scorched his shoulders and arms, ripped open his back, mangled lung, kidney, and liver. I sat there feeling myself a heretic, believing only in this one-shot life and the body. For the crime of destroying the body of Prince Jones, I did not believe in forgiveness. When the assembled mourners bowed their heads in prayer, I was divided from them because I believed that the void would not answer back. Weeks wore on. Nauseating details slowly dribbled out. The officer was a known liar. A year earlier, he had arrested a man on false evidence. Prosecutors had been forced to drop every case in which the officer was involved. The officer was demoted, restored, then put out on the street to continue his work. Now, through additional reports, a narrative began to take shape. The officer had been dressed like an undercover drug dealer. He'd been sent out to track a man whose build was 5'4" and 250 pounds. We know from the coroner that Prince's body was 6'3" and 211 pounds. We know that the other man was apprehended later. The charges against him were dropped. None of this mattered. We know that his superiors sent this officer to follow Prince from Maryland, through Washington, D.C., and into Virginia, where the officer shot Prince several times. We know that the officer confronted Prince with his gun drawn and no badge. We know that the officer claims he shot because Prince tried to run him over with his Jeep. We know that the authorities charged with investigating this shooting did very little to investigate the officer and did everything in their powers to investigate Prince Jones. This investigation produced no information that would explain why Prince Jones would suddenly shift his ambitions from college to cop killing. This officer, given maximum power, bore minimum responsibility. He was charged with nothing. He was punished by no one. He was returned to his work. There were times when I imagined myself, like Prince, tracked through many jurisdictions by a man in a criminal's costume. And I was horrified because I knew what I would have done with such a man confronting me, gun drawn, mere feet away from my own family's home. "Take care of my baby," your grandmother had said, which was to say, take care of your new family. But I now knew the limits of my caring, the reach of my powers, etched by an enemy as old as Virginia. I thought of all the beautiful black people I'd seen at the Mecca, all their variation, all their hair, all their language, all their stories and geography, all their stunning humanity, and none of it could save them from the mark of plunder and the gravity of our particular world. And it occurred to me then that you would not escape, that there were awful men who laid plans for you, and I could not stop them. Prince Jones was the superlative of all my fears, and if he, good Christian, scion of a striving class, patron saint of the twice as good, could be forever bound, who then could not? And the plunder was not just of Prince alone. Think of all the love poured into him. Think of the tuitions for Montessori and music lessons. Think of the gasoline expended, the treads worn, carting him to football games, basketball tournaments, and Little League. Think of the time spent regulating sleepovers. Think of the surprise birthday parties, the daycare, and the reference checks on babysitters. Think of World Book and Childcraft. Think of checks written for family photos. Think of credit cards charged for vacations. Think of soccer ball, science kits, chemistry sets, racetracks, and model trains. Think of all the embraces, all the private jokes, customs, greetings, names, dreams, all the shared knowledge and capacity of a black family injected into that vessel of flesh and bone. And think of how that vessel was taken, shattered on the concrete, and all its holy contents, all that had gone into him, sent flowing back to the earth. Think of your mother who had no father, and your grandmother who was abandoned by her father, and your grandfather who was left behind by his father. And think of how Prince's daughter was now drafted into those solemn ranks and deprived of her birthright. That vessel, which was her father, which brimmed with 25 years of love, and was the investment of her grandparents, and was to be her legacy. Now at night I held you in a great fear, wide as all our American generations took me. Now I personally understood my father and the old mantra, either I can beat him or the police. I understood it all. The cable wires, the extension cords, the ritual switch. Black people love their children with a kind of obsession. You are all we have, and you come to us endangered. I think we would like to kill you ourselves before seeing you killed by the streets that America made. That is the philosophy of the disembodied, of a people who control nothing, who can protect nothing, who are made to fear not just the criminals among them, but the police who lord over them with all the moral authority of a protection racket. It was only after you that I understood this love, that I understood the grip of my mother's hand. She knew that the galaxy itself could kill me, that all of me could be shattered, and all of her legacy spilled upon the curb like bum wine. And no one would be brought to account for this destruction, because my death would not be the fault of any human, but the fault of some unfortunate but immutable fact of race imposed upon an innocent country by the inscrutable judgment of invisible gods. The earthquake cannot be subpoenaed. The typhoon will not bend under indictment. They sent the killer of Prince Jones back to his work because he was not a killer at all. He was a force of nature, the helpless agent of our world's physical laws. This entire episode took me from fear to a rage that burned in me then, animates me now, and will likely leave me on fire for the rest of my days. I still had my journalism. My response was, in this moment, to write. I was lucky I had even that. Most of us are forced to drink our travesties straight and smile about it. I wrote about the history of the Prince George's County Police. Nothing had ever felt so essential to me. Here is what I knew at the outset. The officer who killed Prince Jones was black. The politicians who empowered this officer to kill were black. Many of the black politicians, many of them twice as good, seemed unconcerned. How could this be? It was like I was back at Moreland again, called by great mysteries. But by then, I didn't need any call slips. The internet had bloomed into an instrument of research. That must strike you as novel. For all your life, whenever you've had a question, you have been able to type that question out on a keyboard, watch it appear in a rectangular space bordered by a corporate logo, and within seconds revel in the flood of potential answers. But I still remember when typewriters were useful, the dawn of the Commodore 64, and days when a song you loved would have its moment on the radio and then disappear into the nothing. I must have gone 5 years without hearing the Mary Jane girls sing all night long. For a young man like me, the invention of the internet was the invention of space travel. My curiosity in the case of Prince Jones opened a world of newspaper clippings, histories, and sociologies. I called politicians and questioned them. I was told that the citizens were more likely to ask for police support than to complain about brutality. I was told that the black citizens of PG County were comfortable and had a certain impatience with crime. I had seen these theories before, back when I was researching in Moreland, leafing through the various fights within and without the black community. I knew that these were theories, even in the mouths of black people, that justified the jails springing up around me, that argued for ghettos and projects, that viewed the destruction of the black body as incidental to the preservation of order. According to this theory, safety was a higher value than justice, perhaps the highest value. I understood. What I would not have given back in Baltimore for a line of officers, agents of my country and my community, patrolling my route to school. There were no such officers. And whenever I saw the police, it meant that something had already gone wrong. All along I knew that there were some, those who lived in the dream, for whom the conversation was different. Their safety was in schools, portfolios, and skyscrapers. Ours was in men with guns who could only view us with the same contempt as the society that sent them. And the lack of safety cannot help but constrain your sense of the galaxy. It never occurred to me, for instance, that I could or should even want to live in New York. I did love Baltimore. I loved Charlie Rudolph's and the sidewalk sales at Mondawmin. I loved sitting out on the porch with your Uncle Damani waiting for Frank Ski to play Fresh as the Word. I always thought I was destined to go back home after college, but not simply because I loved home, but because I could not imagine much else for myself. And that stunted imagination is something I owe to my chains. And yet some of us really do see more. I met many of them at the Mecca, like your Uncle Ben, who was raised in New York, which forced him to understand himself as an African American, navigating among Haitians, Jamaicans, Hasidic Jews, and Italians. And there were others like him, others who, having gotten a boost from a teacher, an aunt, an older brother, had